Hello and welcome to the next episode of What is Global Health, a student-run podcast series by the Journal of Global Health at Columbia University. In this series, we interview experts in the field to learn more about topics ranging from COVID-19 to menstrual health and hygiene. We aim to factor all elements of identity, race, gender, sexuality, religion, and more into discussions of global health. My name is Kyle Tong, and I'm a first-year Columbia engineering student. I got to speak with Professor Bill Bauer about tuberculosis, health training, and his experiences in health at the international scale. Let's get started. To start off this podcast, could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Bill Bauer, and I work in the Department of Population and Family Health at the Mailman School of Public Health.
Great. I know a lot of our listeners are really interested in public health and getting involved. Could you talk a bit about how maybe you got started on this path and what decisions led you to be here today?
I think I got involved in public health in sort of an unorthodox route, in that I knew people who were volunteering with a nonprofit foundation in California that did health work in the mountains of northern Mexico. And so I went and volunteered and was trained to be like a village health worker. And then I worked training village health workers and writing books about that and networking with other groups. So I worked for 11 years with a network of community health programs in Mexico and Central America before I went to Columbia to become, on staff in the Department of Population and Family Health. And training of health workers, usually lay health workers, village health workers, has always been what I've concentrated on.
Wow. Did you think that was where you're going to go, outside of when you went out of college?
It's interesting. I grew up in Venezuela, so I grew up speaking Spanish. And I also had some health problems where I knew that the medical stuff wasn't that hard to understand, but I didn't think they were explaining it to me clearly. So I thought to myself that I have a skill that I can explain it in simple words in English and also do that in Spanish. So I was looking for a place to start out doing that, and working with this group in northern Mexico was the opportunity.
That's great. Do you have any advice on people who are trying to navigate the public health career field or anything like that?
I would say that would constitute the old days, when you still had outsiders coming in and actually providing healthcare because there was a lack of services. There were traditional healers and ways people dealt with things themselves, but health services were far away. And I would say now in most countries, the level of health services is higher. There are more trained staff. And I think that outsiders can help more with ideas, program development, monitoring and evaluation, and sort of developing the capacity of local groups to provide those sort of services for themselves. So things have evolved over time.
I see. And in regards to after your work in northern Mexico, how did you could you go over a bit how your career developed after that?
Well, after working in Mexico, I was invited to join the Population and Family Health Department's International Training Unit. And so we conducted training courses in sort of maternal child health, family planning, those sort of aspects of public health in mostly African countries, maybe 6 or 8 African countries, also Nepal, Haiti, and other places. And we tried in as many places as we could to develop a training team, a local training team that would carry on those training courses. Mm-hmm. So we did trainings in New York and then maybe 6 or more training courses in other countries, and got those other groups going, doing the training themselves.
To clarify, was this already were you already working specifically, specializing with tuberculosis, or was this just more general training for those
areas? This was general. It was more about identifying community needs and resources, and then in the area mostly of primary health care, which, as defined by the World Health Organization, it's not hospital-based healthcare. Primary healthcare, nutrition, family planning, safe motherhood, immunization programs, oral rehydration to prevent people from dying from diarrhea because they get dehydrated, and family planning and contraceptive use, all of those aspects of primary healthcare.
Did you find that these These healthcare workers or lay healthcare workers are mostly like completely inexperienced, or did they have like some base level where they were building off of?
I would say they always had experience knowing their local context, the local myths, the local truths, what people believed, how things are done. And I think that we tried to add to that with evidence-based solutions like oral rehydration or effective contraceptions or immunization programs or nutritious foods for kids for weaning, whatever it might be as a primary healthcare intervention.
Would it be possible for you to give me like an example of that?
Well, I'm thinking of an example and say in Sudan. There were refugees in Sudan, and we were working with a team of doctors to train people that would manage rural hospitals and the catchment areas around them. And we would go, say, to go to a refugee camp and measure to see what proportion of kids were malnourished or not. And then, in order to prevent that, we worked with local midwives who knew and had been taught nutritious foods that you can make with locally available ingredients that will keep a child between, say, age 6 months and 2 years well nourished with enough calories, protein, and other micronutrients so that they'll grow well. And local people can teach that to others in practical ways. So we trained the doctors, doctors trained the nurses and midwives. Nurses and midwives would do the workshops with people in the refugee camps.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Did you find that you usually this was like how you usually like you found a community with like a certain need, and then you would address that by like using in and like fusing in like the local community's resources that they already had? Or did you find that this was like less of a common methodology, and more often it was that you just applied like general like advice or general resources to help a population?
I'd say we always tried to tailor the program exactly to the community. So when we did this sort of a thing in Nigeria, where, like in a lot of West Africa, the marketplace is a very common place where people congregate, we would train people who sold products in the marketplace to be like the community health workers. In Nepal, in different parts of the country, there would be, I guess, official community health workers, village health workers that were designated as part of the health system, and we would work to enhance their skills. So in each place, it would be different, and the local beliefs, the foods available, the types of contraceptives or the types of treatments for malaria or whatever might be different. And so our training always would be adapted to that area.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you were there like was your work mostly in like helping them get set up with training, or did you also like follow through and see like the effects of training, like following the data of maybe the impacts of what the training had and like adapting off of that?
It's interesting that you bring that up. We did build in field follow-up as part of our evaluation of training. So we would go back 2 or 3 months after a training course, we would go back to the field, visit trained people, and see how are you doing? Tell us what you've done since you got back. What obstacles have you had? What successes have you had? What could be done so that you could more effectively use the knowledge and the skills that you were trained to use? And then some of that we could give technical assistance and advice right there in place. We would go with a local supervisor so that they could be backing that up and help with local solutions for it. But at the same time, if there were things that management needed to do or changes in policy that would make things work better in the field, we would take that feedback and then back to the programs higher up. So we both tried to help right there in the field, in a village, in a small clinic, or whatever it was, as well as tell the people running programs higher up how they could back up the trained people.
And then from
Few
like
people ask about field follow-up and that, and that's actually there are like four levels of evaluation of training, and that's one of the latter ones is to go and see how people are actually performing in the field and what you can learn from that. So yeah, that's a very good question.
Could I ask the other steps of the process out of the four?
There's a The guru of training evaluation is someone named Kirkpatrick. And he says the first level is you try to find out what are people's reaction to the training? What did they like the most? What subjects do they, what did they learn that they can go and apply? What did they not like? Just their satisfaction with the course. Second level is immediately after the course, what are the changes in knowledge, skills, and attitudes? Third level is what are they doing on the job? Back out in the field. That's the level that you were asking about. And then fourth level would be what impact is it having on health, on communities, on other, aspects of development. So yeah, that it's a good model that a lot of people who evaluate training follow.
And obviously it's like a different scenario between like communities in need and like teaching students at Mailman, but do you see you apply these similar like routines to lecturing?
That's interesting. Definitely, in my training, both personally face to face with students, as well as through the course evaluations, we try to learn how do people react to the course? Was it too long? Was it too short? The balance of asynchronous or synchronous meetings. Okay, are the readings too much or is it too easy? Whatever it is, those sorts of reaction to the course. Then gains in knowledge and skills, those are measured by our assessments, our tests, our, papers or whatever we ask people to do. Then what do they do in the field? There's the difference between training and education. In education, you educate people and then they go forth into life and that's it, they're gone. Whereas in training, you're training people to do a job and they go back to doing that job or they go to doing that new job and you sort of, work with them more afterwards. You can go and see what they're doing. I honestly think that the School of Public Health does send questionnaires in this to students afterwards, and more have like an alumni network where students can say, "This is my job. I've been promoted to this. These are the skills I'm applying." But it's something that we're actually looking at doing. I'm on a core advisory group that's trying to advise mailmen on their core in the School of Public Health, the core, which is the first semester. And we're going to be reaching out to alumni. What did you learn that's the most useful? What was in the core that was not useful? What do you wish had been done better? And try to learn in that way. So that's following up, say, at level three. Level four is what difference is it making in society that that's often beyond, I haven't been doing that.
That makes sense, yeah. And sort of circling back to your work with like communities in need and like primary care, when did you decide, or I guess what when did was the transition made to like go towards like specifying in like tuberculosis or HIV/AIDS from like primary care actions?
Sure. I worked with the primary care training and stuff in Latin America, then in Africa, also in Bolivia. And then I moved back to the United States. And when I moved back to the United States, I was looking for a new job. And I knew Tom Frieden, who worked with the Department of Health in as a commissioner for tuberculosis control in New York City. And I applied for a job in the education and training department, the unit that was there. And I worked there for 5 years. It was really fun because I got to go deeply into tuberculosis. I knew some of it before because I'd encountered it in other countries and trained health workers in general how to deal with it, but I learned much more about it specifically. And I helped guide the city's health department training and professional education and their educational materials about tuberculosis for another 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah,
And
that was a lot of fun.
did you, or for our listeners who may not be as like knowledgeable, could you explain a little bit about like tuberculosis and why it's different from like influenza or other diseases?
Okay, something like the flu or measles, it's easily catchable. If we're in the same room, the same elevator, or something like this, and you're sneezing, you don't cover your sneeze and all this, I could catch it. Okay, tuberculosis is a slow-growing germ, and you're not likely to catch it from one sneeze or one cough. I think if we lived in an apartment building and we were a family, and there were five of us, and one of us was sick with tuberculosis and coughing, I think maybe two out of the five people there might catch tuberculosis from that person, but the others wouldn't. It's not like as instantly or rapidly spreadable. Also, it's a slow-moving disease. I mean, it's going to attack more vigorously young kids, kids under two, kids under five, people who have diabetes, people whose immune system is weak if you have HIV or some other condition. But it's a slow-moving disease. And different than influenza, for which maybe there's not a treatment because it's a viral disease. Tuberculosis is caused by a mycobacteria, which means it grows slow, it doesn't reproduce quickly. The antibacterial medicines that could fight tuberculosis can only be effective when the germ is multiplying. So you've got to take it for a long time so that any one of the germs you have in your body will have some time when they'll be multiplying, and then the medicines can get it. Otherwise, your white blood cells will go and clean up and kill the rest. But you've got to take a treatment which, in some time in olden days, it used to be not that long ago, in the 70s maybe, a year-long treatment. Then treatments were 9 months long. Then treatments are 6 months long. Now treatments are 4 months long because there are better medicines for it.
And how did you find like working with the New York like Department of Health? Or a Department of Health, the like landscape of like tuberculosis to be in like New York or even maybe like in the larger like East Coast area.
Well, when I joined TB Control, it had just turned from its peak. It had almost like high 3,000s, 3,800, 3,900 cases in 1 year diagnosed in New York City. And so I helped train more people and to do good TB control work and drive the cases down. With tuberculosis control, prevention is and treatment are close because somebody with TB, active TB in their lungs, they're coughing out the germs, they can spread TB to somebody maybe, one or two people a month until they get treatment. So if you treat them, you'll be preventing TB because they won't be spreading it to others. So treatment is prevention in tuberculosis. The other thing is that the medicines have to be the correct medicines and taken, I would say, fairly carefully. They call it adherence. You've got to really stick to the plan of which medicines you should take, how often, and for how long. You really have to stick to that plan. And that's why they use what's called directly observed therapy, where a trained person will watch you either in person or over Zoom or in some sort of a, supervised way, watch to make sure you're taking the medicines regularly. That's the only thing that's been shown to really make sure that people take the full course of treatment. And then, of course, taking a full course of treatment of the right medicines doesn't allow resistant germs to emerge.
So one of the reasons for like why it's so or so dangerous and like still like prevalent is the fact that it's even when it's like not symptomatic, it's being like spread throughout the however months or however many years, like the person spreading it could be like asymptomatic.
Okay, usually the person who would be spreading it does have symptoms. They're sick, they're coughing germs out into the public, and that's spreading it. However, other people who breathe those germs in, the first thing that happens to them is they will get an initial infection, which their body can deal with, and then the germs kind of get latent. It's like the germs hide in your body, encapsulated, and that's called latent tuberculosis infection. And that's exactly what you said. It is asymptomatic. You are not sick. You feel nothing. You don't have a cough. You cannot spread it to others. Yet the germs are hiding in your body. And maybe in the first, maybe 5% of people might break down with TB in the first couple of years, but then after that, another 5% will get TB later in their life if they ever have a severe illness or their immune system gets weak or they're just unlucky. So, yes, people who have latent TB infection are asymptomatic. People who have TB that's active and they're coughing, they can be spreading it to others.
Okay. And is that also part of the reason why maybe when you think of like 3,800 cases as being peak, it's not that dangerous, but you still have to like ensure that you're like clamping down to make sure that this doesn't become like a ballooning like or a domino effect later down the line?
Yes, because Usually, when somebody gets tuberculosis, someone goes and interviews them and explains to them about the disease and how important it is that they know that, yes, it's treatable, and yes, they have to take the medicines regularly and get lab tests. And also, tell us who you've been breathing air with, who has been in enclosed places with you since when you first started coughing until now. And so you come up with a list of contacts, people who likely breathe there with them. Usually it's people where they live, where they work, where they have certain social activities. And so those people need to be examined to see if they have latent tuberculosis or not. And maybe a small number of them may also have caught, have developed the active disease of tuberculosis.
I see.
So you need to go and do a contact investigation. So you're right. Maybe for each person with disease, you may find on average five contacts or more that you need to examine. So yeah, right there, you're looking at a large number. From 3,900, you're looking at maybe 20,000 people who are your contacts that you need to examine.
And then, so you have worked in like tuberculosis field as well internationally with like other countries as well.
Actually, only when I worked in Latin America, I would occasionally see people with tuberculosis and work with doctors or community health workers to follow up and make sure the treatment was there. I didn't ever work with a program in tuberculosis control overseas, except for once going on a mission to India to help assess training needs for training. And they had training of doctors, training of treatment supervisors, training of nurses, training of lab technicians to help in the diagnosis and all this. And we had to determine what numbers of people needed to be trained, what skills they already had, and where the gaps were, and then what sort of training courses of what duration and all this, and how many of them would be needed to gear up to improve the national program.
I see. And well, I guess given your like knowledge of like the disease and also like your experience internationally, would you ha be able to like hypothesize why exactly we see that in America and other like developed nations, TB isn't it's still like something that needs to be addressed, but it isn't as prevalent as in say like Africa or some other countries in the world where it is like an impending problem, maybe even like the leading cause of death in that country.
I would say that one of the ways that public health has made a difference in life in the United States and many more developed countries is by having there be cleaner air, cleaner water, less crowded housing, better work conditions, better nutrition. So if your body is well nourished, if where you live and work, the ventilation is good, and you're not crowded with people. If there are fewer people coughing, all this, then there will be less of a disease like tuberculosis. So I think that in cases where people live in crowded housing, where people are less well nourished, then you'll have more tuberculosis.
And would you think that's in conjunction with like treatment availability, in these parts of the world?
Absolutely, yes. I think in the United States, the CDC has done a good job of making sure that state and big city programs have adequate funding to deal with tuberculosis, given their configuration of state and, public and private health services, to deal with the problem. Whereas I think a lot of other countries have trouble having adequate funding, to deal with the problem, both the diagnosing of it, the treating of it and following up. And then once you've got that under control, then it's really important to think about all those people with the latent tuberculosis. You're not dealing with just the tip of the iceberg. That's the people who are coughing and who are sick, but you're dealing with people to whom it might have spread and who might develop it in the future. Now, there is a treatment for those people who have latent tuberculosis, but instead of taking four medicines for, say, 6 months or 4 months, they've got to take maybe one or two medicines still for, a period of months, And so it's again much more effort to go around to people who feel healthy. They're not coughing, they're not sick, but they still have to take a medicine for a number of months to prevent the chance of them having tuberculosis in the future. That's harder to convince people.
I see. And
Yeah. How would you feel it if somebody came to you and said, well, a test shows that you have a latent infection because you breathed air. And we want you to take a medicine for 6 months or 9 months. Would you take it?
I definitely would be more skeptical, yeah. Or
Yeah,
I
you might be skeptical. You, if you had side effects, you might say, well, nah, I don't want to. And so, yeah, that's the challenge of really lowering rates is not only to deal with the tip of the iceberg, that's the people who are sick with it, but also those who have the latent infection.
I see. And in our last couple minutes, do you have any, if you could, looking at like the tuberculosis like landscape today, what recommendations or what would be your like ideal future for how we manage and deal with the disease in the coming years?
Well, it may be pie in the sky because people have been working on it for a long time. But if there were an effective vaccination against tuberculosis, that could really help because once given to somebody, no matter how many doses it might require, then they would not get tuberculosis, would not get sick, would not pass it to others, and maybe it would eliminate the latent TB that they have. So an effective vaccination would make a big difference.
I see.
Right now, the immunization that there is called BCG. And what it does is it's effective at preventing really young children from getting the most deadly forms of the disease. So young kids won't die of it, but it doesn't prevent them from getting infected. It doesn't prevent them from getting sick. It just prevents the most deadly forms in young kids. And it's, yeah.
And
We
in the
need an effective vaccine for people of any age that will have them not get infected, not get sick, not be able to spread it to others. That would be great.
okay. And in like the research and development of the vaccine, do you see it as like promising work, or do you see it as more of like a dead end endeavor?
I think it's going to happen in my lifetime. I'm encouraged by having seen improved diagnostics. It used to be that some tests for diagnosing TB took 3, 6, or more weeks to give a result that you could make decisions because you would see what antimicrobial medicines would be effective against the TB germ that somebody has or which ones wouldn't be. That has now gotten down to fewer weeks or fewer days. So the diagnostics are quicker. And then in the last 5 years or more, there have been some powerful and well-tolerated medicines that have shortened the treatment, even the treatment for multi-drug resistance, resistant TB that used to be, say, a 2 year treatment, 18-month treatment. Those treatments have been shortened to maybe only 6 months. And the treatment for somebody with regular TB has been shortened maybe to 4 months. So shorter treatments means there's less time for you to fall off the wagon and not take it. There's less time and less cost for following up doing directly observed therapy to make sure somebody's taking it every day. And the treatments are more effective. A higher percent of people achieve a cure from it. So because I'm encouraged at the development of diagnostics and new medicines, I'm willing to believe that a vaccine will come. It'll be tough because the germ has a very waxy capsule on the outside of it and it reproduces very slowly. And so, whatever medicine or vaccine has, it's got to act at that time that the germ is vulnerable. That's tough.
Let's see. Well, thank you so much on that positive note. I think we'll finish the podcast. Thank you for coming. And I hope to potentially be able to talk to you in the future.
Very glad to talk with you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for tuning in to this installment of What is Global Health? We hope you enjoyed, and as always, be on the lookout for new episodes every other week. Also, be sure to check out our online blog posts on our Columbia Journal of Global Health website, and we'll see you soon.